Greetings, my friends, and welcome to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. I'm Paula. History is infinitely richer, more varied, more colorful, and yes, messier than the version we learned in school, says Pulitzer Prize-winning author Tony Horwitz. In this case, he's talking specifically about the period between Columbus and Jamestown, 1492 to 1607. Cabeza de Vaca is part of that rich tapestry.
I admire him. He's, you know, the great naked wanderer, and again, one of these rare sympathetic figures who essentially is conquered by America and becomes a defender of the Indians he had set out to conquer, and writes a wonderfully vivid account, to me, one of the great adventure and survival stories of all time, and the first great American road trip.
After working as a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and a staff writer for the New Yorker, Tony Horwitz chose to move to book writing to have, in his words, the luxury to delve more deeply into history and context. The results include Blue Latitudes, Confederates in the Attic, and Baghdad Without a Map. Bill Russell and I knew that exploring a blank spot in American history with Mr. Horwitz would once again recast our sense of our nation and ourselves. Tony Horwitz, the scientists say that pattern recognition may be the key to intelligence. And I was thinking about that as I read A Voyage Long and Strange, thinking, well, that's fine, but the pattern might be wrong. And you might be thinking that you got the pattern, and then you look again, and it's kind of that reverberation process of, you remember those tiles on the floor, the old-timey tiles, the black and white, and they kind of oscillate? Yeah. I felt that way thinking about North America and the whole coming together of the human species after 60 or 80,000 years, as we reunited with our brethren and sisteren, if you will. Uh-huh. Did that question of pattern find
a pattern
you?
In the sense of the pattern we have in our heads about how the story went doesn't fit the reality? If that's what you're asking, absolutely. Not only are the myths wrong in many cases, but even the bits we think we know about are mostly misconceptions. So partly it was discovering all these stories that didn't fit the pattern and I didn't even know about, but it was also revisiting parts of the pattern that actually, once you take a hard look at them, they rearrange themselves, whether it's Columbus or John Smith or the familiar figures, in fact, become quite unfamiliar once you kind of delve into them.
That's good news and bad news, isn't it?
To me, it's all good news.
Know the truth, and the truth shall set you free.
Keeps you gainfully employed.
it's more that it's the truth is so much more interesting than the fiction, and perhaps that's always true, but it's particularly true in this case, is that the real story of this period is infinitely richer, more varied, more colorful, and yes, messier than the version we learned in school about sort of brave Columbus and solemn pilgrims in funny hats. That wasn't really a very exciting version, in my view.
It also really wasn't sort of it.
No, it was, you know, it was false, but I think it's one reason kids are turned off by history. We're taught this sort of, you know, powdered wigs and buckle hats and the same old stuff.
The end.
The end, and it's really not very exciting, apart from being wrong.
I think I'm Miss Potted Histories.
Potted?
Potted.
Potted like plants?
They're the simple-minded version. And listening to you respond to that, I hadn't really made the connection. In a way, what you've just done is a continuation of at least Confederates in the Attic, because it's very much that same sense of, on the one place you're looking for, I mean, you're looking for the absolute history, but then there's the reality of people's relationship to the context in which they're a part. You know, with respect to Southerners, there's a weird aberration in there. But our relationship with history is much richer than facts and what happened before. Right. Ultimately, we inhabit that history. And that's where it starts getting complicated and interesting, isn't it?
Well, it's part of what I like best is trying to figure out where the two intersect and how the past bleeds into the present in ways we may or may not be aware of, but also how the present bleeds into our view of the past. So yeah, ultimately it's very hard to separate the two. And also, if you look at the history of memory, how we've remembered, say, Columbus has been on a roller coaster over the centuries. In 1892, on the 400th anniversary of his sale, he's a hero, and by 1992, he's a villain. And who knows, you know, where we'll be at, you know, whether people even remember him by 2092. So the story of memory itself is constantly changing. So yeah, it's not a static story.
And in a way, there's a comic book kind of caricature that goes on when you've got to either have him as villain or hero, that there's all that subtlety that has gotten washed out. We will come back and explore with Tony Horowitz much of that subtlety, or Tony subtlety with much of the Horowitz, in just a moment when we return with Tony Horowitz. We hope you'll be with us. Welcome back. We're delighted to be with Tony Horowitz, who has written a number of books that invite us to think a little bit anew. When you were talking about truth and fiction, I have learned that in reading a book, it's always important to read the acknowledgments. And I was absolutely, talk about pattern recognition, delighted to see that Jill Lepore is one of the people that you thank. Absolutely. She quite recently, at least in I'm always behind on my New Yorkers, but in a fairly recent New Yorker, Jill Lepore wrote an exquisite piece on fiction versus nonfiction, on what is history and what is fiction, with fiction when it is relegated to sort of a make-believe.
Right.
Well, that ain't true. And Jill Lepore's ideas about the nuance, the subtlety between history as it is written and fiction as it is written, is what you've done here, I would think, would just thrill her, that it's an exemplar of this of this tossed salad that is all of the above.
Well, also, as I remember that piece, one of the interesting things she pointed out is history as we think of it as it's written today is a really quite a recent invention, basically late 18th century, and that before that, history was a very different thing. Yeah, it was saga, it was myth, etc. It wasn't, there wasn't this notion of trying to put together history the way we do now.
As if you could do that.
Right, exactly. It's a sort of Enlightenment idea. And I think it's relevant to this story because one of the reasons the Pilgrims have been sort of enshrined as our founders is that that happened really in the early 19th century, in the early years of this new science of history, was really when they began writing America's history. And it was mostly Protestant New Englanders. And
the writers.
The writers. And as they looked back to the country's origins, perhaps not surprisingly, they elevated their own forebearers who had landed at Plymouth.
Surprise!
And diminished the role of the non-English, of Catholics, of Spanish, French, and even of Southerners. Hence Jamestown, even though it precedes Plymouth, to this day still plays second fiddle somehow. So I think it kind of fits a little bit her paradigm also of just how she was describing the history of history itself.
She also, I think it was in that article, had a sort of almost a throwaway line that there are people in academic situations, universities and colleges, that talk of history as a science now, as if there is a science of history, which particularly given the kinds of things we're talking about, seems to me to be a really a misguided idea that either it misapprehends what science is, and science, that's still up for grabs, or more perhaps dangerously misapprehends the human experience and our relationship to ourselves, our communities, and our pasts.
Right, and how subjective it inevitably is. On the other hand, I think you can go too far the other way into whatever you want to call it, postmodern view that there is no truth, there are no facts. And I run into it a lot with this subject again, where people want to believe things, and not necessarily the old myths, there are all kinds of new myths. Columbus was Jewish, the Chinese discovered America, etc., etc. People who want to latch on to what, in my view, are myths based on very slim or non-existent evidence, partly arguing that, well, your facts are not facts. There are no facts. We can believe anything. It's all point of view. And I'm not particularly comfortable with that.
Well, you are a reporter after all.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
And we'd like to think that matters.
Yeah, and I think you can make a good faith effort, and you obviously have to recognize it's always going to be subjective, and particularly when you're looking at a period this long ago, your sources are slim and often unreliable, so you can't be cavalier about saying, well, because it was written down by a conquistador 450 years ago, it's therefore true. Here's evidence. On the other hand, to throw that away completely and say we can't come to any consensus about what actually happened makes me uncomfortable.
Absolutely. Well, and that goes back to the Enlightenment piece. Yeah. That evidence, there is something to be said for having more or less agreed to evidence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I guess I think of that in the context of the other side of that with. Mm-hmm. Joseph Ellis's biography of George Washington,
His Excellency,
in which and it was in this the context of history was a very interesting story that I simply hadn't heard, which is that Washington almost all of his life was writing his memoirs with history in mind,
right?
And rewriting.
So it is not it's not sufficient to go back to the original text. It's not as sufficient. You know, you're in Newfoundland, and I think, and somewhere in there, am I really learning something? Are these people, I think, barking mad?
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, what we take for evidence becomes, I would think, a real challenge. And in some ways, it seems as if your writing, the way you approach these subjects, tries to subsume that contraposition between
subsume the contraposition. You want to try that again?
In English?
Yeah.
No, he's the writer. The challenge between essentially what can I trust? What can I rely on?
Exactly. It's a little bit, I feel, what I had to do as a journalist in a different way because my sources are completely different. But that's
an important story, though, that we forget about journalism.
Yeah, it's you need to weigh your sources. Why is this person speaking to me? It's a little bit like Washington with his memoirs. Mm-hmm. People have an agenda. Why is this person speaking to me? Are they reliable? How can I check it against something else, etc.? So I think in some ways that's what you're doing with history as well. But, you know, it's always a challenge. And I just think you have to be modest about it. You have to assume that you're never getting the whole story and be honest with the reader about that and not present it as if it's cut and dried.
You've just given me a major ping. Journalist, the very word, one keeps a journal. Mm-hmm. It is about journaling. It's not that you are God. It's not that you are you're not Mercury with the fact lantern in your hand. Yeah. Journalists are presenting their perspective on a journey that is at that moment and that story. And I'd really never thought about the journal part of journalist, which is different from reporter.
Right.
And what you're doing here, I mean, it is really quite an important distinction between reporting as best one can, fact, as best we can understand. We've been watching lots of mysteries lately, and even fact is pretty messy if you're looking at murder mysteries, which I love. This notion of the journey, you've lived that. This is sort of the journalist gone nuts, isn't it?
I never actually thought of it that way. I always thought journalist and reporter in the modern sense have become synonymous, but, you know, that's an interesting way to look at it. And certainly, I would say this isn't standard reporting. It's one reason I love to write books. I loved working as a newspaper reporter, but it does have real limitations
including the assignment editor.
The assignment editor, but, you know, beyond that, well, length, obviously. It's great to be able to spend a few years on something instead of a few days. To have a strong point of view, which in reporting you don't, at least overtly. But also, to be a little more creative, perhaps, in how you go about your reporting, for lack of a better word, and to do it through travel, to do it through anything that comes your way, really. Any straight conversation, any bizarre experience can somehow become part of the story, which can be a little hard to do in journalism, or also to bring yourself into the story. As much as I do in my books, so, you know, you can do it a bit in journalism, but it only if
you got really forgiving
small doses, and only if it's really relevant. Otherwise, it's awkward to put yourself in a newspaper story. Yeah.
There is also, I think, just the requirement of surface, that daily, particularly daily journalism.
Surface.
Only dealing with the surface. Oh. People, you know, an event. Mm-hmm. An earthquake in China.
Yeah.
Bodies, things, buildings falling down. Yeah. The context is, you know, basically gets lost in this. And to me, in many ways, the kinds of work that you're doing is a much better first pass at history.
Mm-hmm.
Than a lot of people talk about journalism as being, you know, the first, you know, the first
rough draft,
and a lot of people go back to journalism to report the histories, and a lot of times that's all that is available. The challenge frequently is in the contextualization of it, and what you're doing in these books that I think you were probably not able to do as a reporter is to contextualize both in terms of the physical environment in which these things happen, but more importantly, the historical environment, the cultural environment, all the things that start making sense of just this event.
Right. It's really about time and length more than anything. You know, I had the luxury of working at the Wall Street Journal when actually they did give you a lot of time and a lot of space by newspaper standards. Right. We would write stories that were, you know, 3,000-4,000 words long. Some of them you might spend a couple months on. That was very unusual then, and now I think extremely rare in newspapers. So it's really just about having the luxury, as you do with a book, to take the time to delve in a little deeper and have the enough words to tell a story with some context. But I think you're right. Newspapers are a little allergic, I found, to history. I mean, they don't call it the news business for nothing.
It's new.
And I've always been a history nut, so I was always trying to sneak in a few paragraphs of only semi-relevant history, just to give the reader a little context. Well, I'm in Bosnia, and this is how this country was formed, etc. And, you know, when your stories get cut, which they inevitably do, I found the paragraphs of history were almost always the first to go.
Well, and Bosnia is a wonderful example of that. I mean, they're you know, almost any place you go, you simply cannot make sense out of the Balkans.
Yeah.
If you don't know that history, and it goes back 1,000+ years.
Right. And that was probably a poor example, because actually that would have been the rare story where it was so history haunted and it was so obviously relevant to the story that actually I would say we were able to get more history into our stories about Bosnia than almost anywhere else. But, you know, if I were writing about some place where it wasn't as obvious, then the history would go.
As in rediscovering the new world. A Voyage Long and Strange. Tony Horowitz is our guest. We all will be back in just a moment. Join us. We are with Tony Horowitz here on The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula. The third leg of that stool, reporters do that which is new. Journalists keep a journal, are journaling, so it's a little bit bigger. We've done a number of shows over the last couple of years with people who are writing what I think of as literature. So it's back to Jill Lepore and the fiction. Mm-hmm. All of these are very blurry lines, and all of them are very important. When you go into something like A Voyage Long and Strange or Confederates in the Attic, being able to keep that sense of appropriateness, I would think, would be very important, whether you're slugging through the gumbo of the Mississippi River or you're following in the Sonoran Desert. I mean, these are scary things you're doing, Tony. Doesn't your mother worry about you? Certainly your wife does.
Appropriateness in what sense? You mean in tone or in the...
Yeah, there is craft to journalism.
Right.
Yeah, there is craft to literature. Mm-hmm. And there is also just the human experience. When you're going into these really weird places, when you're finding yourself in a knight's armor that could have been a Spaniard in the Armada, I would think it's just so weird that it's easy to blend into literature.
Oh, I see. I don't, you know, I'm quite conservative on this. I think there really should be a firewall between fiction and nonfiction. And I think we've been on a slippery slope there for a long time, and partly what we were talking about before, a feeling that well, there is no truth, and the fiction can be as true as nonfiction. And of course it can. You can get at emotions and things you can't get through in nonfiction. So as long as it's presented as fiction, that's great. I think if you present something as nonfiction, it absolutely has to be that. Doesn't mean you can't be literary, whatever that means, in your writing. And, I learn much more about keeping a plot moving along from reading fiction than I do from reading nonfiction.
And you really do that.
And I try and do that. And how to make a character compelling, what details you include, dialogue, etc. But I think I at least feel you have to be very careful about never crossing that line, at least not intentionally. I'm sure we've all, made mistakes in our nonfiction. But I certainly try and stay on what seems to me the nonfiction side of things. I don't know if this is what you're asking, but what I did struggle with, particularly with this book, is more the, in terms of appropriateness, the historical story in this instance is quite dark. The body count is really high. There's a lot of genocide and disease. My own travel, perhaps it's my personality, whatever, tends towards antics. I tend to gravitate towards the absurd, the ridiculous, making fun of myself, making sometimes gentle fun of the people I'm with. I struggled with this book of not letting that go as far, maybe, as it has in my previous books, because I felt it was too jarring and perhaps at odds with the historical substance of the book. I wanted it in all cases to illuminate the history, and if the tone was a little too jolly,
A really dark story.
It was a poor match for the historical story I was telling.
And yet, you got to keep me engaged in this because it's so dark and there's so much blood and gore, and it is so horrific.
Yeah.
Over such a long time,
right.
That if you didn't keep me coming back...
Yeah, you'd just tune it out. There's only so much you can take. And also, I think there is a lot of humor in the historical story, too. I mean, my favorite parts from the accounts from these periods is really the sort of drama of first contact between Europeans and natives. And yes, sometimes that leads to violence, but often it's this sort of absurd theater of mutual discovery of trying to communicate, pantomime, sharing each other's food, all of the things that happen when cultures collide for the first time. And so I think there's also humor in the history, and I tried to, or at least humanity in the history.
And you do find ways to say, it could have been different.
Right.
Look at this just a little bit differently,
right.
And you've got a whole different present, past, and future.
Right. I mean, again, in another sense, I think this is where the pendulum has swung from one extreme to the other, where 50 years or more ago, these explorers were regarded generally as heroes who brought, Christianity and civilization to the benighted natives. And now we've swung to the opposite extreme, where they're seen as nothing but the advanced men of empire and bringers of germs and genocide. And I think it's more complicated than that. And I don't certainly want to be an apologist for any of these people, and I hope I'm not in the book. But on the other hand, I think we can see their humanity even as they're doing things that we certainly would not approve of.
The other overlay on this, of course, is you are putting yourself in the physical positions 200, 300, 400 years later and dealing with current people who currently inhabit these. And typically, you're essentially dealing with eccentrics, which in itself, I mean, that helps the storytelling along, but it also lends to, it could easily become absurd, which it doesn't. But just the current reality of the things you're describing takes you to places, physically, but more importantly, socially.
Yeah.
The people that are odd. Which I would think is part of the charm of this, and it's also part of how you're able to bring it to life, and they're odd.
Yeah, no, there is a high oddball quotient, and again, that may be me. I gravitate towards these people, or they're vivid on the page, they're good material. I mean, I don't interview a lot of college professors, or I don't include them in the book. I interviewed a lot of them. There's nobody I would rather sit and shoot the bull with. When it comes to writing, it can be hard to make an academic come alive on the page. That's not always true. So they will inform my work. But when it comes to describing social interactions, Yeah, I would like to say lively rather than odd. Charles Hudson.
Interesting.
Charles Hudson, the great DeSoto scholar here at the University of Georgia, he's a colorful guy. I don't think he's odd, but he made for a great interview, and I had a good time telling it in the book. But he's a serious scholar as well. But there are plenty of eccentrics, and hey, a lot of this book's in the South. You can't miss them.
That's why we need the South, I guess.
You know, that's why I keep doing books, you know, here.
But I think I think it was a couple in somewhere in deep outback New Mexico.
Yeah, those are the folks I was thinking about.
That have been reading teasing apart the old documents.
Yeah.
About the conquistadors, about the all of the writings of that period, and they sit at the end of a road, and just the two of them
from a sort of 60s perspective, they see themselves as very anti-establishment figures, and are sort of revisiting these conquistadors through that perspective. So again, I wouldn't call them odd, but they're certainly unusual.
They're outside the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Being 40 miles down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, their lifestyle is very outside the mainstream.
But they also, my recollection is that they also had come to a remarkably balanced perspective, and it seemed. Particularly describing, as you described their background coming out of the 60s, you would expect it to be aggressively anti-establishment, anti-imperial, and they're reading, which is appears to be, and this goes to what you're talking about, facts, a diligent, thoughtful, absolutely. Knowledgeable, founded reading of the text has led them to a place that seemed to me both balanced, but also nuanced and very well informed.
No.
Tony Horowitz is not odd. Tony is interesting. And he's also, and he's also a reporter and a Southerner, having grown up in Virginia. Well, come on. Looking
Washington,
around.
Washington, D.C. I wish I could say so, but.
I'm just back from Washington.
Yeah,
it's Southern. Trust me.
In certain ways.
Anyway, all of this informs his wonderful books, which now include A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. We will be back with Tony in a whole new world when we return in a moment. Be with us. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. What a pleasure to be with Tony Horowitz, who has taken us at the leading edge to a variety of interesting places in your book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. In your book, Confederates in the Attic. In your not-so-new book, where you took us off to see where Captain Cook had been. And then, of course, all those years, including a Pulitzer Prize at the Wall Street Journal. One of the things that I found interesting is how I hadn't expected all those academics that you acknowledge at the back end. And yes, you did a tremendous amount of research and a tremendous amount of just that gut work that you got to do to figure out what the story is. I was surprised how many times the unexpected person took you to an unexpected place that was just a gold mine, simply because you came in politely and asked around, and you really do like to go have that beer at the end of the day.
Sure.
But that simple humanity of being open to everyday people took you to just glorious places. Mm-hmm. And that alone almost felt like a lesson. Mm-hmm. If one were to be open, that there are worlds to discover.
I think it's the dirty secret of journalism or reporting, whatever we're going to call it today. It's not that hard if you approach people, as you say, just with a certain amount of courtesy and curiosity. Everybody will talk to you. In the 20-plus years I've been writing as a reporter or book writing, usually just wandering around, meeting people for the first time, the number of times people have refused to talk to me, I can count on one hand. And that includes, you know, terrorists and Saddam Hussein's son, who I ran into in a nightclub once in Baghdad, and I thought, what the heck? went up and talked to him. I didn't really get anything interesting, but he talked to me. I think we make assumptions about other people that for whatever reason they won't talk to us.
Well, and there's a great line when you quote somebody, gosh, you're hard to get rid of. Come on, get in the boat. We'll go.
Sometimes you have to exploit people's hospitality, I have to say.
And invite them to be inviting. That's not exploitation.
It's a little exploit. You know, people, particularly in the South, are very hospitable. They won't tell you to get lost. And if you hang around...
No, but they will not tell you anything.
Sometimes, but if you hang around and hang around, often as I did with the person you're describing, who is an Indian in Virginia, belongs to a tribe that has really been through a lot from white society, a little bit wary of strange whites rolling in and asking personal questions.
And As well they might be.
And I hung around and after a while kind of broke the ice. You know, sometimes you can perhaps push that too far, but I do find just showing up and showing up again and again, if you feel you've got potentially rich material, is worth the effort. It doesn't work every time, but in general, people will talk to you.
It was not Woody Allen, it was Napoleon that said that 90% is showing up.
Is that true?
He stole it.
Napoleon made his career by laying siege to a town, I think, in Spain that the French had been trying to deal with for some time, and he was an artillery officer, and he just stuck around and kept raining artillery on the town until they finally gave up. But it took a long, long time, and that's the source of it. But it also, what you're saying reminds me of Danny Colson, who was deputy director of the FBI, who said precisely the same thing about solving crimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Exactly.
If you talk to enough people, somebody will tell you who did it.
But it is precisely the same thing as
what you're describing. And I think, you know, that's a lesson that a lot of us forget. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people in the profession forget that
the profession of
journalism, news, whatever we're talking about. And I think it's particularly destructive, now that I'm on a tear, when what passes for news now largely is people like us sitting around and having opinions about things they have no direct contact with.
You got to get out and talk to people.
Exactly. And what you said earlier, that we don't, our reporters, our media don't do that the way they used to. We don't have the bureaus around the world we don't have the people like you.
Well, no, I think there's still, look, I'm a great defender still of newspapers. I think there's a lot of great reporting out there. I think it's simply the resources aren't there to do it, as much of it as there used to be, the kind of in-depth stories. And they're competing with blogs and CNN and every, you know, 24-hour news, so that the whole mission has changed. So I don't think it's that there are people who aren't doing it or who don't want to do it. I just think the resources to do it are diminishing, and that's a real pity.
Well, here's a possibility for you. This may be, you tell me if it's an analogy or a metaphor. I can never remember which is which. I was with a young friend recently when I said I went to Washington. Right. We did a road trip, and she thought we were going to get on the highway, and that would be the superhighway, the interstate, and drive up there, and then I took the train back. Well, phooey on that. We went all back roads. Yeah. There were roadblocks, so we had to go a different way. We had to use the map. We're halfway into Virginia. I said, "Have you ever been on the Blue Mountain, the Blue Ridge Parkway?" And she said, "What's that?" And I said, "Ooh."
Beautiful.
So we go back through some small towns, and it was on a Monday, so there was no traffic. It was all to ourselves. It seems to me that an awful lot of journalism has gotten stuck on the interstates.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right,
ignoring what is so rudely called the flyover country, and one of the things that she said, as we were in these mountains and we were in the Smokies and we were on the Blue Ridge, she's never seen the big mountains, so this was she was just head shaking and how did people do this? Well, as you did your own journeys, the arduousness of all of this is impossible to imagine if you don't have Tony going through doing it on superhighways and in an air-conditioned car and beer at the end of the road and stuff. The accomplishment, for all that I do not admire what they did, is awesome.
Right.
And it's as if we've gotten stuck on the superhighways and have forgotten mm-hmm. all of the richness that is there mm-hmm. to be had.
Right. Well, it relates to the people I'm writing about. Yeah, I don't think we have to admire these people in any way to still recognize that what they did is significant and awe-inspiring.
I mean, and it happened.
De Soto, who to my mind is probably the greatest monster in the book, is also just incredible. He leads this 3,000-mile death march across the South. And as one military person I interviewed in the book said, you know, Navy SEALs today would be dropping dead, you know, after a day of what he was doing for 3 years.
And that guy was holding up the Navy SEALs as the ultimate.
Exactly. Navy SEALs are tough dudes. And he was saying they couldn't have hacked this. So I think, you know, it is striking to read the accounts and then get out in the landscape, be out in the Sonoran Desert when it's, you know, 120 degrees to get a little sense of, or swamps of Florida, what these people put up with. And yeah, as you say, to get away from the quite cushy interstate travel that we do. But I think also back to sort of interstates, I think there's, and this is not about journalism really, it's about all of us and how we think about travel. I think there's this notion abroad that every place looks the same and that there's almost no point in traveling anymore because you know, it's all one big Starbucks and, you know, and obviously if you only go on the interstates and to Atlanta Airport, it does all look the same.
Strip mall heaven.
But, you know, as you were just describing, you don't have to get very far off the interstate to find that there are still tremendous regional differences, tremendous local differences. There's a whole nother world, you know, an hour's drive from almost any major city. And it's not that hard, again, to get out there and discover it.
So if you know to do it.
Well, again, it doesn't take much. You know, you just got to, as you say, get off on those small roads and then, God forbid, stop and talk to a few people.
I've been told by people who are supposed to know these things that in America's national parks, something like 99% of people, 90%, never get more than 300 yards from the parking.
Yeah. From their car.
Yeah.
And the fact
I'm surprised they get that far.
Well, I think he was being generous. And if you go that extra 100 yards,
mm-hmm. right.
you are in a radically different space.
Wilderness,
You're actually in the national park and not in the national parking lot.
Yeah. Good point.
And at the end of that trip, I ended up in Washington, D.C., which was our destination. And this is sort of ending that metaphor. We're going to put a little bow tie on this. And I wanted to walk between the Lincoln Monument and the Capitol. I really believe in democracy. I like Lincoln at one end and the people's representative, even if they don't do it very well, at the other. And I stood there, I said, this is a mall. Let us think of this as America's mall, not the strip malls and the shopping and stuff. And there was also that sense in this book, in A Voyage Long and Strange, to be looking at what it takes to grow from a time that is deeply magical thinking, which sometimes I think is this time, but the propensity for magical thinking among your exploring guys, whether you're talking about the Vikings 500 years before the 500 years ago, or you're talking about the Spanish and then the French and then the English who are coming with various agendae, metamorphosis of how the world looks, what it is that gets us to a time when we really could be a self-governing people if we choose to be. Mm-hmm. That sweep of history must have been thrilling for you.
Right. Well, particularly in terms of the landscape and what's very painful to me as someone who's a history nut and also, you know, I love my national parks and just nature generally, it's just how much of it we've paved over. And, you know, but that being said, you know, an hour from Atlanta, you can go to Etowah, which I talk about in the book, that again, maybe people here in Georgia are aware of it, but I don't think many Americans know there was this fabulous mound culture here when Europeans arrived. This was not a virgin wilderness. This was a heavily populated, very sophisticated native culture here. And, you know, those places do still poke through, but it's next to a trailer park, and it's you have to drive past the Glad Wrap factory to get there. And we've kind of done our best to change that landscape that these early explorers were describing that's so wondrous. Part of what it's about is really just the wonder of America. Or, you know, and what it helped me rediscover was sort of, yes, this is a an amazing country physically, you know, those huge rivers and mountains and forests. And these guys are really describing that in a way that can, you know, be hard to remember in this day and age as you're driving through those strip malls.
Part of this, you talk about it, is the myth-making that goes on. We have a colleague, Richard Slotkin, who's written about the American myth, read everything, even Fenimore Cooper, some of the really unreadables, yeah. To me, unreadables, who argues, and a lot of people disagree with him, but argues that the American myth, as we have thought of it, has died sometime mid-Vietnam War. And that we're in need of a new myth. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, you've been sort of doing, you've been reconnoitering the territory mm-hmm. from a historical standpoint, but also from a modern mm-hmm. standpoint, because you've also, as a reporter, dealt very much with the here and now. One of the things he says any candidate myth, and he didn't put one forward, that for a new American myth, has to somehow or other deal with violence.
Mm-hmm.
Who gets to use it? Under what circumstances? Against whom? Mm-hmm. And, of course, race.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, do you have a sense of anything emerging, that from right. your wide right. exposure and your right. thinking about it and sort of muddling through? Do you see?
Well, violence.
Wait,
yeah.
wait a minute, guys. You can think about okay. that, Tony. I'm going to give you a break.
Okay.
We'll be back in just a moment. Give him a chance to take a deep breath and say, "Oh my goodness." Tony Horowitz will be with us when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell, I, Paula, will be with us when we return. Welcome back. We are pleased to be with Tony Horowitz, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. Myth. Wow, Bill. But that also is where you end up.
And it's all through it.
You track the myth from the beginning. You track it in kind of comic book fashion in a complimentary way, about Plymouth Rock.
Right.
What did we all get taught in history, right. which
but
was pretty much comic book.
It's also the myths that the Spanish were dealing with, the French, the English. Right. They all had this, this worldview
and
that
we
was
come
predicated
out of myth. It's,
on, yep. on a set of shared stories,
right. mm-hmm.
which is basically a lot of what these myths mm-hmm. are, but they lead right. to perceptions.
Right.
So having set the predicates.
Yeah, well, just first on Slotkin's point, one thing that's very striking about this era is certainly the violence and the race. A lot of what becomes the American story has its roots in this era before the English even show up, or certainly before Plymouth. Obviously, the violence against natives all through this era, but African slavery begins, very early in Hispaniola in the early 1500s with Columbus. And then it begins in Jamestown in 1619. So even before Plymouth is founded, you've got the roots of a lot of the American story. So I think it's important to recognize where, there are a lot of roots feeding this tree, whatever, that became our history. As to a new myth emerging, I don't know. I would like to think we could live without those myths, and we can have still shared values and a shared history. But does that need to become a new myth? I don't know.
Well, part of this is myth is one of those really ambiguous words.
Yeah.
I really think of it in the terms that Joseph Campbell uses,
yeah.
which is the unifying story.
Right.
Stories that we share, that we tell one another, mm-hmm. that essentially establishes, in some ways, the downside, us as opposed to somebody else, the other.
Right.
But it ultimately is a way of defining the community, and
right.
we are just such quintessentially social creatures.
Sure.
Well,
and
Campbell's premise is that myth needs to be grounded in the globe rather than in the tribe. I mean, he gets there at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. That myth could include what you opened to me, and I'd completely forgotten, the 500 years that comes before
right.
Columbus. Oh, we've got 1,000 years
yeah.
of Europeans
right.
on our continent.
Yeah, we think of one of the myths we have is that we're a young country, we're the new world. Well, we're a lot older than we think, and that's speaking only for the European history. Right. Obviously, the native history goes back 12,000 years or more.
And
so
we forget that, too. The natives are newcomers
exactly.
as well.
So, I think we have to kind of tear down the old myths before we can get started building a new one. I think the real wild card in the equation is the changing demographics of this country.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that I think Confederate remembrance will never go away, but I have to believe it's going to diminish over time as less and less people in the South are from the South. As the South looks more and more like the rest of the nation, and as more and more Hispanics and Asians and others come here, that Confederate story, I have to believe, is going to have less resonance. In the same way, if you imagine current trends 50 years down the road, will the English story and Plymouth have the same hold on people in 2050 when, you know, a much higher percentage are of non-English extraction? I don't know.
Cornel West has, now that I think about it, it's not a myth so much as his set of predicates, which he takes back to the Greek tradition, the Jewish tradition, and the African-American tradition. He speaks of the Greek tradition of dialogue, you know, as being very, 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 very important, which particularly in a country that for which democracy is very central would seem to be important. He also talks of the importance of the Jewish insistence on justice, mm-hmm. also a fairly palatable concept. And then he adds in the African American tradition, which is very central, as you say. It's all through American mm-hmm. history. From day two, assuming right. the first people were day one, which he characterizes as tragicomic hope, which is in a way it goes to what I think you're looking at, right. which is, you know, if we got to have these stories,
right.
can't we make them a little more interesting, you know, update them, resynthesize, right. and I think as much as anything, he's arguing for that resynthesis that, mm-hmm. that and to extract from the resources we have, which certainly are the Black experience,
right.
And he looks at jazz and a lot right. of other things, but it also increasingly includes that Hispanic influence lots of others.
I think it's a good point, because as dark as this era is that I'm writing about, it's incredibly rich culturally. In a sense, you know, early America looked a little like America today. You mm-hmm. have this very mm-hmm. diverse, fluid society, almost a kind of international food fight mm-hmm. with Spanish, French, Portuguese. You've got African Americans here, very early natives, of course, Moors, some Jews. You've got a real, I wouldn't call it a melting pot.
Germans and Poles and all those Vikings.
It certainly wasn't a melting pot, but it was an interesting cultural stew, and I think recapturing that as part of our national identity, which we talk about in relation to immigration, but when we talk about our early history, it's always this kind of Anglo thing, and then everything that happens later is in opposition to that. It's immigrants coming to an Anglo land. Well, I think we can flip that around and say it was really Anglos who came to what was already, a largely Hispanic continent, but an international place.
Well, and particularly, we also ignore the French.
Completely.
I mean, you know, we were bracketed by the French and the Spanish.
Yeah, exactly.
The English settlers.
English colonies,
I also think of that story that I don't think I'd heard before of the, I think it was near the time of the Pilgrims, when one of the English people exploring New England, what is now New England, came across a boatload of locals, you know, one of whom was wearing a top hat or yeah. something.
Oh, tell us that story.
Yeah, it's Bartholomew Gosnold, and he's the first Englishman known to have led an expedition to what's now New England. There may have been earlier ones, but he's the first we know about. They're looking for sassafras, which was believed to be a cure for syphilis, so they weren't coming for religious freedom. And they arrive first off the coast of Maine, and the first people they see are these curious characters in what looks like a European boat, wearing European clothes, and they turn out to be Indians who have had contact for decades with Basque fishermen, and they speak a few words of different languages, and one of the Englishmen writes, you know, they seem to sort of know much more about us than we knew about them. And again, to me, it was just an example of the English being latecomers, that here they were thinking we're arriving at this unknown shore. Well, it wasn't unknown to many other European peoples, and there had been quite a bit of interaction already.
This is a really important story when you get this really narrow-minded, bigoted, I would say, mm-hmm. immigration argument mm-hmm. that somehow we have to protect a white Anglo-Christian state, right. almost a WASP state, and right. it's just factually inaccurate.
Yeah, I think, you know, however you feel about that debate, let's ground it in the actual history, which was that this was a largely Hispanic continent before the first Anglos ever got here. That doesn't give any one group, you know, the ultimate right to it, but to sort of cast this as an Anglo nation, it isn't now, but you know what? It wasn't at the start of our European history either. It was a lot more complicated.
I have a bumper sticker that a friend gave us some time ago that has a group of, I think they're Apache, and the wording on it is fighting terrorism since 1492. Just to put things in
And also Homeland Security also with some pretty tough looking Apache. There's all of that. And there's also people have joked about going over and sort of claiming, discovering Spain, some Indians. I mean, the whole notion of discovery, obviously, and of claiming territory as they did back then is a kind of peculiar notion when you think about it.
Parochialism just seems to be written into the gene pool, doesn't it?
I mean, and sadly, kind of fear of the other. I found it very interesting, the scene in which the Vikings encounter natives of Eastern Canada for the first time, and this is two branches of humanity that have been separated for tens of thousands of years, and they don't even explain why, but as soon as they meet them, they kill them. And they describe them as skraelings, is the Norse word, which means sort of ugly, screeching wretches. That their first reaction to this otherness is kind of, they're strange and they're ugly and we have to kill them. And that didn't happen in all cases, but it is kind of a sad comment on how humans often confront, you know, the other.
And you are very good about turning that around every time you have a chance. Mm-hmm. With a yes, and it didn't have to be that way. The opportunity for it to be other is there, and occasionally somebody will shine a light for you.
And it was a relief to me when I found those stories, because as you said earlier, it would be too unrelenting to only tell the grim side of this story. And the ones who do show humanity, who are often Spanish, which I like, because again, it upsets our stereotype of the Spanish is all kind of, you know, butchers and inquisitors. In fact, there were many Spaniards of conscience, and some of them really did try and reach across the canyon of language and culture, and they didn't succeed in the end. But
Well, they could have been worse. if you would, I really like the story of the woman, and it's interesting to see women's stories peeking out where you can find them. The one woman who is a native, who is the connector between the Spanish coming up one way and the Spanish coming another way, and there's one lone woman.
Yeah, it's an incredible story, as briefly as I can tell it. Coronado leads an enormous Spanish expedition up from Mexico in the 1540s, and at roughly the same time, De Soto is coming across from Florida with his own army, and Coronado's men capture an Indian woman, and then she escapes, and this happens in Texas. She's running across Texas to escape to her homeland, and she runs into De Soto's men, who have come the other way across the continent, and is captured by them. And these two armies never intersect. As far as I can tell, they didn't really even know the other was there, but this unfortunate Indian woman, about whom sadly we know almost nothing about, except that she's referred to in both accounts, and the De Soto
as tattooed,
men,
as I remember,
a tattooed Indian woman, and as De Soto's men say, remarkably, she was giving the names of these Spanish captains in this other army, and that she was this connecting link between the two greatest expeditions of this era. So
this reminds me of a story that colleagues in Montana told us, I think Blackfeet, about that there was a tradition that there was at least one person in every village who had seen both coasts.
Both the Atlantic and the Pacific on foot.
Well, that's all they had. And it deals with this parochialism. We think of, you know, these villages as very constrained, without contact. Right. And you talk about the trade back and forth.
Exactly.
But that was, and the trails were there.
Yeah. These explorers, also another myth, I think, is, you know, they were blazing trails through the wilderness. I don't really know if that was true with Daniel Boone and the others. I doubt it. Certainly in this era, they were following established Indian trails.
If it was, they were stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let's see. There's a road over here, or you can take your axe and go this way.
Right, exactly.
What you gonna do?
We're not going to be stupid, but we are going to go away for just a moment. We'll be right back with Tony Horowitz. A couple more minutes with Tony Horowitz. We've been talking about a voyage long and strange, which of course to me sounds like a boat. And the big addition to this story is the horse.
Right.
Which changes much of both North and South America. Jared Diamond talks about what happens when you introduce a major mammal, a large mammal. The horse changes so much.
Right.
Is that part of what delighted you in telling the story?
Well, again, I love the whole story of first contact. And, you know, and usually I'm telling it between man and man, or man and woman, or European and native, but when Coronado and his men ride all the way across the Great Plains and into central Kansas, they astonish the Plains Indians, who have never seen horses before. So in this instance, it's man and beast encountering each other for the first time. And the Spanish are amused because these Plains Indians, who we think of course very romantically as mounted warriors, were using dogs as their beasts of burden. And, you know, the Spanish wrote about that. Unfortunately, we don't know in this instance what the Indians thought about these horses. We only see it through the Spanish eyes. But there are records from other areas where Indians were understandably very confused. Were man and beast one? You know, what were these creatures? But obviously, it did quickly transform Plains Indians into the greatest native warriors on the continent. So it's another example about the image of America that we have in our head actually reflects a long era of European contact that we've tended to neglect or forget about.
We do know what the Spanish thought of the buffalo, which was a wonderful story. All of these are stories within stories within stories. Yeah. You've got a little nest going here, haven't
there's
you?
There's so much to work with. Yeah, the Europeans are terrified of these buffalo, and they don't have a word for buffalo. So they call them vaca, Spanish for cow at first, but they recognize they're really not cows. And, you know, they've got kind of goat-like beards, and, you know, their heads are down, and their bodies are kind of unbalanced, and they really don't know what to make of them at all. And the horses are quite frightened by the buffalo as well. So it's another wonderful story, and there are many others like that. Even, you know, modest creatures to us today, opossums, were, you know, a strange sight to Europeans when they first saw them. So they're really, you know, when I subtitle it Rediscovering America, it's really partly, for me, rediscovering the wonder of this country through the eyes of these early explorers, because there's so much that we take for granted. Even fireflies, the way they describe fireflies the first time they see them, these sort of sparks of light at night. You know, imagine how magical that must have been if you've never seen a firefly before. To us now, that's a, you know, the most common sort of suburban backyard sight. But to early Europeans, it was a wonder.
And 1,000 years of stories.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, and I could only tell a small portion of them in the book. That was the real challenge in the end, was choosing which stories to tell and which to leave out, because I didn't want it to be a multi-volume work.
I have mythologized you. I have decided that you must identify with Cabeza de Vaca.
Well, I don't know. I admire him. He's, you know, the great naked wanderer, and again, one of these rare sympathetic figures who essentially is conquered by America and becomes a defender of the Indians he had set out to conquer, and writes a wonderfully vivid account. To me, one of the great adventure and survival stories of all time, and the first great American road trip. Yet again, it's
how do you characterize that road trip? The 25 words or fewer version.
Yeah, you know, four shaggy guys, these four castaways, kind of staggering across the continent. It's a bit of a buddy flick, and weird encounters with shamans and peyote. It's you know, it's a little bit of a 60s road trip in the 16th century. And yeah, I love that story. So I'm glad you mentioned it.
You make the whole story of America from 1,000 years ago forward, and both Americas that really shouldn't be America at all, and give us lots of options for thinking anew. Thank you, Tony.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great chat.
We thank Tony Horowitz for his willingness to take these journeys and for the work needed to turn the stories into books. We are grateful for the skill and insight which makes our world richer and a bit more strange. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well. Thank you.